Well, first of all, I think it's actually 3-2, and I think that the independents added to the Democrats are enough to defeat the Republicans, even if it's a straight party line vote. Now, you can pay your money and take your choice as to these theories. Certainly, there is a theory out there that this is actually being manipulated, this race, in favor of the Republican candidate. That just as the Republicans manipulated the choice of George McGovern with dirty tricks and whatnot to have what they felt was the easiest opponent against Richard Nixon. I supported McGovern, but nonetheless, it is well documented that the Republican Party played dirty tricks and tried to take the other Democrats out of the race. There is a theory that the power behind the scenes manipulating things and chasing other candidates away is coming from the wealthy backers on the Republican side. I don't have any evidence as to whether or not that's true. Could be, but I'm not alleging it. I don't say things I don't know. I'm just saying that theory is out there. But the other possible explanation is that the Democrats are just plain scared. You know, this has been the trend nationally. They're just so bent on winning at any price, and they believe that if they have a candidate who is just 1 millimeter, if that, to the left of the Republicans, you know, they can pull in. That's the way you pull in the independents and so forth. You can see a reflection of this in Kerry's campaign. Kerry certainly isn't out there condemning the Iraq War. He's a very disappointing candidate. People who backed Dean, for instance, are very disappointed in this kind of approach that he's taking. I think Kerry will win, but this just seems to be the prevailing wisdom, if you call it that, in the Democratic Party. And so I don't know. It's a little of both, maybe. I really don't know how to explain it. Well, let me give you an example. I spoke in a little labor council meeting in Elmira, and I spoke there. It's not like I was, you know, 100 miles away, and they were going to take a meeting, a vote at that meeting on who to endorse, not who to recommend the endorsement of to the broader labor council. And after I left the room, not when I was there, after I left the room, somebody said, "You know, he's somebody who makes his living suing people for money. That's the kind of guy he is." And the next thing you know, they have voted 14-1 against me. Well, first of all, it's completely false. I've never brought a lawsuit for money in my life. The Cornell lawsuit, there's no money involved in that, and it's hardly a secret. So I was just plain smeared after I was out of the room and had no way to defend myself. And when we looked into it a little more, we found out that the union rep who made this smear is actually somebody who carried petitions for Sam Baron. I can't prove that Sam Baron put her up to it, but that's been the way they've been. They use proxies, just like Dan McCandless, the county chair of Cattaraugus, is technically the one bringing the challenge to my petitions, but obviously he's a stooge for Baron. And they kind of made a bad choice because, you know, a county chair, it's not ethical for them to be doing this. They're supposed to be impartial. They're not supposed to be shilling for one candidate and trying to destroy the others. This is so basic that the law, even though they're allowed to bring challenges to the Board of Elections, they can't take a challenge to court. They are the only people who are prevented by law from taking a challenge to court because county chairs aren't supposed to do it. But that didn't stop Dan McCandless from bringing this challenge against me. I always say we've got to think it before we can do it. A lot of the problem is people just aren't in the frame of mind. We are very dispirited. We are very despairing. And what I said in the very first speech I gave of this campaign, that the opposite of despair is not hope. The opposite of despair is duty. We have a duty to this country. We are the inheritors of this country. There's no one but us. And so we have to find the strength to press forward, even when the odds are against us, even when we are getting put down, dissed, manipulated, and thrust aside. We have to keep on. We have to be smart. We have to keep our wits about us, but we can't let our despair bring us down because a lot of the obstacles that are thrown up can be thrown down, and we have to remember that.
If people want to contact you to find out more about your campaign or your lawsuit or anything, how can they do so?
Well, I have a website which is www. AldersonForCongress.com. That's AlderSon for Congress. www.AldersonForCongress.com. And we have a phone number for the campaign, which is 866 left out. That's toll free, 866 left out. We could use some volunteers. I think the tide is starting to turn. I think if I can get on that ballot or stay on that ballot, and I think I can, I think that people are beginning to realize that there is a candidate in this race who really does stand for something, and I think that it's not so far from turning around. This is a very winnable race, and with a little help, I think I can do it.
That was Jeremy Weir Alderson, Democratic congressional candidate, facing off against Samara Barand for the Democratic nomination in the 29th District. His website, www.aldersonforcongress.com. Alderson is spelled A-L-D-E-R-S-O-N. His opponent's website, samaraforcongress.com. Samara is spelled S-A-M-A-R-A. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville.
I was young once, it was a long time ago. Things were different than I thought you should know. This old building was once a factory. We made Stetsons, your grandpa and me. It wasn't easy, but at least life was going down. There used to be a city in this town. Rusted rail yard had a hotel and a couple of stores. We had good times here between the wars. It wasn't paradise, but there was music in the street. Right there's where your grandparents first had a chance to meet. They got married in that church. I can still see her wedding gown. There used to be a city in this town. When the change came, it started one by one. First the layoffs, then the factory was gone. Then came the highways, suburbs and Walmart. That was the final blow that tore this place apart. But it seems like just last year, when there were people all around, there used to be a city in this town.
Next, Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters in Seattle makes the connections between war, money, and politics in an interview with the editor of a new book about the global justice movement.
We are talking with Eddie Yuen. He is the editor of the new book, Confronting Capitalism, Dispatches from a Global Movement.
And I should add, I'm co-editor with George Katsiafikas and Daniel Burton Rose. It's a very collective project.
Well, and it's got a lot of stuff in it, so I could see why you'd need several of you to put that together. What was the motivation for Confronting Capitalism?
I felt there was really a need to sort of, for one thing, talk about the histories of where all these strands came from that we saw in the streets of Seattle 5 years ago, but which have been percolating, particularly in the global south, Africa, Asia, and Latin America, for the previous 25 years. And it also, their occurrence that came from within the U.S. from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Because people always say, well, it's the 60s all of a sudden just snapped back into action, you know, in 99. It's not the case. Confronting Capitalism is specifically trying to fill in some gaps for those of us, myself included, who have been so absorbed with the events in Iraq, the Middle East, and currently the elections, that we've forgotten that there's a whole lot else going on in the world, that there is, as the New York Times itself said, a second superpower, that is, of global popular uprisings, which is taking place all over the world and which is really making a difference, so that we're not currently in a situation where we have to choose between Bush-Cheney on the one hand and some sort of Islamic fundamentalism on the other. There's in fact powerful democratic movements which are not only criticizing capitalist globalization but are creating alternatives on the ground. Labels and titles and sound bites often disguise more than they reveal, and this movement has been saddled with this name anti-globalization, which has become a fairly easy thing to caricature because, of course, a non-informed person who doesn't want to look seriously at the arguments can just say, well, you know, you want to go back to a time of simply no trade, or you know, everybody make their own clothes, this kind of thing, which you know some people do, in fact, and you can make a case for it. However, the movement really is better defined as criticizing a particular kind of globalization, but one which has been so dominant in the last few decades that it's been seen to be the only possibility, and that, of course, is the globalization of capitalism or of corporations. This is the kind of globalization where we have a race to the bottom in all things. For example, wages will go to the lowest level. American workers are now competing directly with workers in China, India, Mexico, anywhere else. And the wages will fall to the lowest level that the companies can find. Of course, we shouldn't blame the Chinese and Indian workers, but rather, you know, a system that allows this to happen. There's a race to the bottom for basic health care, for any kind of social services which are being gutted worldwide, which have already been completely destroyed in the countries of the global south. It's a race to the bottom for environmental standards. Of course, remember in Seattle, the demonstrations, sea turtle was a signature emblem because the standards, environmental laws in the U.S., which are actually very good, were basically undermined by the World Trade Organization, which said, well, the rights of the Mexican fishing fleet in this case trump those of local U.S. environmental laws, which means that sea turtles and albatross wouldn't be protected from longline fishing. So this race to the bottom also includes civil liberties now, as we've seen increasingly in the U.S. since 9/11. In the detentions without charge of communities around the country, Arab and Muslim communities, and also in the increased repression at any kind of public demonstration or exercising of free speech. So we're having sort of going to a very low standard of human rights, civil liberties as well. So this is one, on the one hand, the kind of globalization that's being contested, and it's being contested all over the world. However, it's important to remember that the people that are contesting this are also globalized. What's exciting about this movement is that there's a dialogue between so many different communities around the world, from Argentina to Chiapas to South Korea to India. Various seemingly local struggles are networked in an increasingly articulate way, and there's an extraordinary exchange of knowledge, exchange of information that's going on. And it's a movement that takes democracy very seriously, participatory democracy, not merely electoral democracy. And so we see countless models of this. And so in this book, there's accounts from all over the world, and some fairly well-known authors, Arundhati Roy talking about India, Naomi Klein talking about Argentina, Boris Kargolitsky talking about Prague. And in all these cases, you really find there's a diversity. But what makes the movement strong is that, as Marcos said, some Comandante Marcos of Chiapas, of the Zapatistas, said, there's one no, many yeses. So there's many yeses means there's a countless ways in which a new form of globalization is being created. And again, that one way to determine which whether a movement is sort of part of this global movement of movements is does it take, you know, democracy seriously? Does it, you know, come from the grassroots?
Yeah, that's inspiring, especially seeing where democracy, or what we say is democracy in this country, where that's currently heading, choices we're getting there. Could you give us a sense of some of the history behind this movement? Because a lot of people, I think, believe that it kind of started in Seattle, but things were happening long before that.
Yeah, and well, I guess the most important part of the history to the very brief, you know, history to go through is that it's this current cycle of protest starts in the global south, what used to be called the third world, around the 1970s, when you have a real attempt to impose austerity, to take back the gains which nations and peoples had gained during the anti-colonial struggles of the, you know, 40s and 50s, when the British, French empires, and later Portuguese, you know, empires all collapsed. And, of course, the defeat of the U.S. in Vietnam was a big part of this. So there, in fact, at that time, Latin America, Africa, Asia, there was a lot of progress being made in people's basic living standards. And what happened was the IMF and the World Bank, that is these institutions which are basically controlled by the rich countries, in particular the U.S., imposed what's called structural adjustment. Basically, through a series of financial maneuvers, which are well documented in this book and in many other places, the standard of living in all these countries was dramatically reduced. You had a massive transfer of wealth from the south to the north in the form of debt, in the form of corporate profits. And the magnitude of this transfer is around $150 to $200 billion a year, which is absolutely staggering. This is from the poorest countries to the richest countries. And so you ended up with a situation where in Latin America, the 80s was called the lost decade. The 90s was even worse. Countries like Argentina that were basically had a standard of living on a par with European countries were reduced really to total impoverishment. In the cases of Africa, you have outright starvation and famine, which has been naturalized, of course, by the media, this idea that somehow, oh, Africa's always been starving. It was not the case, even relatively recently. These are, you know, the direct results of policies which are called free trade and also neoliberalism. So this is the term that comes out a lot in globalization, anti-globalization movements, because this whole constellation of policies, which involves privatization of any public goods, it involves, again, the race to the bottom, reducing the cost of labor, reducing any social spending, reducing the sovereignty of any kind of local government, whether at the national or local level. This sovereignty has been lost to the global financial system and these institutions, the World Bank and the IMF and the multinational corporations. So this massive austerity project, this massive privatization, was not uncontested. And everywhere in the world, there was resistance. And this resistance, of course, often took the forms of sort of sporadic, say, uprisings against fuel price increases or food price increases. This happened around the world. There's a map in the book that shows all the countries, not all the countries, all the countries we could find for the 20-year period that had struggles against this. And it's extraordinary. Pretty much every country in Latin America and the Caribbean. And in Korea, you had a general strike against neoliberalism. In fact, in 1997, Philippines, Nigeria, South Africa, Jordan, the list goes on and on. And this resistance over time becomes increasingly networked and increasingly articulate. So it's something people begin theorizing. People begin talking about what's going on here and how is this happening? How is it that we are forced to, our governments are paying off to the very richest countries this debt? How can it be that the poorest countries owe the rich ones? And this was expressed most eloquently probably by Subcomandante Marcos when the Zapatistas rose up in the early 90s, specifically against an aspect of neoliberalism, the NAFTA treaty, which was basically going to displace the people of Chiapas from their land. People that had been cultivating corn for thousands of years were now basically being dispossessed of the land, couldn't compete with the agribusiness corn dumped there through free trade, so-called, by the American companies, and were basically, the populations were forced to leave, were being displaced. So much of the struggle was resistance against displacement. So this movement sort of arrives in Seattle in 1999, and then through a whirlwind, all the rich countries, all the summits, there's a cycle of protests, and that's sort of getting us where we are now. So in a certain sense, you know, the U.S. is kind of the last to know that this is going on. We should mention, though, that in the U.S. as well, we see the exact same neoliberal process. You see the total erosion of any kind of function of the state other than repression. You know, the neoliberal ideology, which is a very, you know, ideological construct that's sort of become common sense now, but it was theorized by some people 50 years ago in the University of Chicago and other places, and they were thought to be crackpots by the Keynesian economists at the time. This, since the Thatcher-Reagan era, has become the orthodoxy, or was until Seattle. Now it's been punctured. But this theory basically argues that the state shouldn't do anything other than repress. That is, the military, prisons, and policing is basically all that the state should do, and that even education, public education, is not a right. To say nothing of health care, child care, anything that people had come to expect in the global north as a result of the labor movements and civil rights movements of the 20th century. So this is all, you know, being rolled back, and you see it in this country constantly with the latest versions of it from the Bush administration budget, but it continued during the Clinton administration at all, the attack on welfare as we know it, and so on. Now, the movements don't necessarily argue for a bigger welfare state. In fact, they really don't. The movements are arguing for something quite different and for autonomy, that is, for community control over communities, over everyday life. So it's not as if the movements are, you know, social democratic in this classic sense, but they're responding to this massive erosion of the quality of life for everybody in the world, and the enrichment of very few corporations and wealthy individuals. And again, the disparity in wealth equality worldwide and in the U.S. has been remarkable. It's increasing dramatically over the last 25 years. And so the protests in Seattle were also about this. It was the impetus and the creativity and the theory was coming from the South, but also people were responding to their own everyday lives. And this is going to continue to be the case in future manifestations of this movement, which will be not just large summits, and probably, in fact, they probably won't be large summits, but I think local campaigns around all kinds of issues.
Yeah, so far it seems that a lot of the attention gets focused on these different ministerials, for instance, Seattle, Genoa, where there were a lot of people in the streets, and then the given governments of those areas had some pretty harsh responses, and that's what made it out on the news. And then it seemed like there's a shift now to let's move these ministerials as far away from where cameras and people can get to them. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, this is something that I think has to do with kind of the self-identity of this movement, because there's not going to be opportunities for these large summits anymore. I think that sort of cycle of the movement is largely over. By the time they planned ministerials in places like Seattle, in Genoa, in Italy, in Quebec City, Canada, they were really riding high. I mean, this neoliberal ideology and the people running it, the WTO, the World Bank, the IMF, they really felt that they had won, that the end of history was upon us, and that everybody just had to go along with it. And so they were having these sort of triumphal meetings in these cities, which were meant to symbolize the New World Order. And of course, this backfired horribly from their point of view. And as you mentioned, the kinds of summit meetings are no longer happening in any kind of accessible places. They're happening, the WTO had their meeting in Qatar, which is a despotic country in the Middle East in which, you know, protests are not even allowed. The last two G8 meetings were in the Canadian Rockies, the French Alps, and the current one is going to be in the Georgia Sea Islands off of Georgia. And all of these places, it's virtually large demonstrations were basically prohibited. It doesn't mean that people aren't going to try to demonstrate and express their basic democratic rights. But the opportunities of a Seattle and a Genoa are not going to be offered, with the exception, of course, of the Republican Convention in New York City, which is Karl Rove's massive historical blunder, thinking that he could exploit 9/11 forever. But the victims' families and police officers and firefighters' families in particular have said no to that. And so it's contested. It's very important to remember that this movement was never simply about disrupting summits. I mean, this was a spectacular way to gather attention, and it's a way in which the media plugged into it, and a lot of stereotypes and caricatures were created. But at the same time, a lot of people were really inspired by these summits. So this book really has, I think, a thorough documentation of that sort of summit, the cycle of summits, the debates from all these demonstrations. I should just mention a few of the sort of points that came out. I mean, one is there was an incredible learning curve that went around the world as these kinds of actions took place. People were really learning from what was successful in different parts of the world. And that really showed, I think, a maturity of this movement and a sort of creativity. For example, in Britain, you'd had a movement for the last decade, Reclaim the Streets, which was really concerned with taking over public space, because one of the things that capitalist globalization does is it destroys public space. All space is privatized. You know, malls have replaced town squares. You know, everything has become privatized, from water to the air to the airwaves. And so reclaiming public space by using the carnival, right, having a celebration, but a non-commodified celebration, a celebration in which nothing was being marketed, nothing was being sold, and in fact gifting as opposed to commerce was the order of the day. This was something which really spread around the world. And we can trace, you know, similar kinds of ideas as they circulated. So this was one of the really extraordinary things about the last few years, is how much interaction was going on from Korea to India to especially Latin America. This was really a process. But again, the summits are only a small part of it. If you look at what's happened in Argentina, especially in the last few years, you'll see that campaigns are really moving beyond, you know, following the agenda of the WTO and the World Bank. It's creating a new agenda. So in the case of Argentina, by necessity, people have had to really become much more self-reliant because the economy just virtually completely collapsed. And it united huge sectors of the population that hadn't been politicized before. And so people started taking over factories which had long been idle and producing for need. There was a return of a kind of barter or gifting economies as a result of the collapse of the currency and the fact that people's savings were liquidated overnight from the banks. And, of course, public councils, neighborhood councils, something like what happened in 1919 across Europe or in Spain in the 30s. This began happening in Argentina. And, again, direct democracy in action. So I think now is certainly a reflective time to think about how movements can begin to take it to the next level in terms of building campaigns and drawing local support and connecting local with global issues. And I think this is taking place in the U.S. as well. I'm hoping at the talk that people will discuss some of the local projects in this regard, but I have some examples as well.
Yeah, I'm hoping you can share some of those examples, because it seems to me, again, one of the problems with our local movement here is that we tend to focus on those big events, the WTO ministerial type things, and then there there's organizing going on locally for solutions to this, but you don't tend to hear about that. And I think people need to hear about that more, both things going on within here in the U.S. as well, especially stuff that's going on outside our borders.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a tricky question because I think that the summits are really important. There's been sort of a backlash against the summits on the part of a lot of activists, which is like, you know, it's drawn too much attention. And this is true. I wouldn't dispute that. At the same time, what the summits do is they bring all the different local activists together and create this kind of space. And also it shows people the strength, the power of the numbers, because as David Dellinger, who just passed away, the great pacifist who was one of the Chicago Eight, he said, you know, the people have more power than we know. It's the title of one of his books. And sometimes these summits, it's a chance to realize that power. The key is to sort of remember it and keep on going. The same with the large anti-war demonstrations. It shows, once again, that this country, it's not just the usual suspects that are waking up. There's an incredible politicization going on now amongst all kinds of people, many people who just are too busy in their everyday lives to be sort of a quote-unquote activist. But people are realizing that something is really deeply wrong with the current situation that goes beyond Cheney and Bush. And people want to get involved in their everyday lives and doing something that's meaningful. But to go to what things happen, you know, during the whole summit period, there was also under the radar lots of grassroots activism, which continuously happens. And, you know, one example would be the environmental justice movement. And there's some pieces in the book, one by Christine Wong, who's a Seattle-based activist, who talk about, you know, this is a movement that's had extraordinary success almost everywhere, where usually it's communities of color and poor communities who find themselves ground zero for the siting of a toxic incinerator or a nuclear dump or something of the sort. There's an incredible success rate of this movement. Whenever these things are identified, communities organize, they usually win. And really, I can't think of a more successful movement in terms of campaigns than the environmental justice movement. Native American reservations are often cited, are used as sites for these dump sites. And so there's all sorts of networks that have taken place. There's organizations, Southwest Environmental Justice Network. There's struggles, for example, Kettleman City in California. It was a Latino community, Spanish-speaking. It was chosen to be the site of an incinerator. The community rose up and stopped it. And then when the same company moved the incinerator to Tijuana, Mexico, that community went there and organized against it there, showing, again, the globalization of movements and showing, once again, that people, once they realize what the stakes are not just simply not-in-my-backyard activists. Mm-hmm. Right? These are people that weren't, again, the usual suspects, but they realized if it's unfair for us to have this, why should we accept that it goes somewhere else to another community? So this is something, one example of something that's been going on continuously and continues to go on. Another would be the ongoing struggles against police brutality in pretty much most major cities in the U.S., and particularly in San Francisco right now. There's a lot of struggles over police killings, usually of young black men, in Miami, in New York City, of course, around the country. When you add these struggles up, you really see, again, resilient community organizing, which are increasingly networked. The same with struggles against prisons, which is really, I think, going to another level now, because for one thing, the prison industrial complex, as it's often called, you know, this fact that the prisons have increased fourfold in the last 20 years, precisely at the moment of the neoliberal project in the U.S., because as all this austerity is imposed, social control is dramatically upped. And, you know, the war on drugs is the consequence of it has been the massive criminalization of huge amounts of young people of color. And so there's been an ongoing campaign against this, and I think it's going to another level now, in part because the budget crisis has created a contradiction, whereas local states simply can't afford this prison expansion anymore. And so they're really beginning to wonder, well, has this all been worth it? You also have alliances with environmental groups and prison activists. In California, again, there was a prison that was, at least for now, has been stopped because of this alliance, because, of course, prisons are taking up prime agricultural land, and same as with Walmart. I mean, this is one of the main sort of expanding uses of land, which has all kinds of consequences. So you're really beginning to see, I think, this movement maturing. Also, the Abu Ghraib prison abuse has highlighted the fact that some of the administrators of this torture and abuse were veterans of the U.S. prison system, and that these policies also take place, and these abuses also take place in U.S. prisons, particularly in the supermax prisons. So this, again, is something which I think is never going to get the kind of publicity that a single spectacular day of action, whether February 15th of last year against the war or of Seattle. And there's countless other examples. So how to network these different movements is, of course, the question, and how to sort of keep them going in sustained campaign in order to have staying power. But one thing that the movement has done is it's really brought an analysis of understanding of how these things are interconnected, and that's what this book really tries to do. And this analysis really comes in large part from the Global South, from people in India and Mexico, in Korea, all about Latin America, from South Africa, who've been thinking about this for a lot longer by necessity and have really, through practice, have sort of come up with an analysis of what's going on. And this is something I think that U.S. activists have a lot to learn from, is to listen to what people in the Global South are saying, where the movements are much, much further along. You know, how to take democracy seriously and how to be effective. So that's an exciting thing.
For those of you just tuning in, we are talking with Eddie Yuen. He is one of the co-editors of the new book, Confronting Capitalism, Dispatches from a Global Movement. Eddie, do you have a recommendation on people when they're ramping up their energy level to get involved with issues like this, whether they should be looking at perhaps starting a new organization versus the idea of finding an organization that's already out there doing good work and helping them out?
I wouldn't want to make a generalization about that. It really depends on, I think, each person and the kinds of organizations in play. I think what I would say about the movements of recent years is that there's been a real rethinking about the relationship between sort of organizations and sort of street movements, social movements. You know, that's sort of a complex relationship, because when you have something like a Seattle mass demonstrations or like the anti-war demonstrations in San Francisco, for example, last spring, you really see a way in which movements are more than the sum total of the organizations. And those are sort of exceptional circumstances. That is when all sorts of people are drawn in to a really an exceptional moment. And that's something which I think people need to learn from, to understand that when movements are successful in organizing, then things become a bit more unpredictable. And that's when I think movements have to be flexible. You know, flexibility is sort of one of the key words of business in the last few years. And it also should be a key word for social movements. That is, don't be attached to the dogma of what the book tells you to do or what is supposed to happen. Because I think right now in particular, there's incredible hunger for change on the part of, I think, the majority of people in this country. And people are really tuning in to new information sources, new media sources. People understand that the media has not been telling the truth. That alone is an incredible first step, the delegitimizing of the corporate media, because from that, all sorts of things can follow. So I think that the movements around the world have shown the power of self-organization. That is, that oppressed people can organize themselves, are capable of organizing themselves. And we've seen this time and time again in Brazil, the landless people's movements, which is just a movement that will not go away because of the income inequality in Brazil is about the worst in the world. And this movement also hasn't stopped once Lula, you know, the popular former labor leader, has been elected president. The movement didn't just go home and say, okay, now our man isn't president, he's going to do the job from the top. It kept on going. It kept on taking over land from the oligarchy, you know, from this giant wasted idle land in many cases. It kept on doing this. These popular movements kept on doing this. I think that's a lesson to be learned for this coming election, that it's whatever happens in November, people have to keep going. That is, if Kerry wins, it doesn't mean go home and, you know, just turn the TV back on. And, you know, there's going to be a lot more struggles ahead. So, yeah, you know, the question, I think it's really new forms of organization. And in this book, there's accounts from all over the world that really focus specifically on how people have engaged in the process of participatory democracy in different places. And I think that's really key. Whatever organization people take on, the movement has been strong around the world because it's organized horizontally and not vertically. And that's made it much harder for the powers that be, when they get into the repressive mode, you know, it's been harder for them to smash it. It's much easier to smash a sort of top-down organization, you know, just go for the leaders or co-opt the leaders. And if the people, the mass part of the movement is just our followers, then it's easy to do. But people in this movement around the world aren't followers. Each person is a leader, I mean, at its best. So it's sort of a project which has different manifestations in different places. I mean, there will be different traditions of how to engage in direct democracy in Argentina or in Chiapas than there are in Seattle. But just keeping sight on that project, I think, is very important for what's going to be successful in the future.
What do you see as the big hurdles then for, I think, for a lot of people listening to this, they're already somewhat familiar with a lot of these concepts, and, you know, we do have an election coming up, and
I think people would appreciate kind of a what's next. What should I be doing next to best expend my energy? Is it communicating to others that, you know, might not normally be getting this information? Or is it, again, you know, connecting to a local organization that might inspire you?
Yeah, I think that what you said is very instructive. I mean, I think definitely communicating to others. I think sometimes things that happen within social movements have become sort of subcultural, or people become, you know, talking to each other, preaching to the choir. This is a, you know, a common complaint. And right now, again, this is a sort of unique time. I can't remember a time when more people have just been, it seems around the country or around the world, are just saying something is just really horribly wrong. I mean, the fact that Michael Moore and even Noam Chomsky are bestsellers, you know, not to mention all the other books, is really telling us that people are hungry for knowledge. And so now is an incredible time to engage in all kinds of discussions and conversations and to sort of be a little bit ahead of the curve, to sort of anticipate what might be happening next. What's going to happen after November? You know, look past November. I mean, certainly the election has taken up a lot of energy, but it's going to be over. And then either way, if there's two options of what might happen, there's going to be, you know, work to be done. So I think absolutely expanding the circle of communication and sort of finding ways to link things that affect, again, people's everyday life. Like right now, the gas prices seem to be something that's affecting a lot of people. And there's a lot of complaints about that. Well, how can this be tied in to the war project, to globalization, you know, to the profits of the multinationals? There's a few good books out now on oil politics. You know, Michael Clare's book, Resource Wars, a new book by George Kafensis that's coming out. These are all things I think people need to study up on. The same, of course, with the Middle East and with Iraq. I think this, by the way, is really one of the most difficult problems for the globalization movement, because there really wasn't the only one part of the world where there wasn't a kind of anti-globalization movement of the same kind as at Chiapas or Seattle or Korea was the Middle East. And so I think it's been very confusing for a lot of people, because clearly nobody in the movement can identify with or support in any way the kind of fundamentalist politics that seem to be going on in the Middle East in large part, or, of course, the horrendous regime of Saddam Hussein, right? These are the bad guys that the U.S. says are bad guys really are bad. And, of course, they're also, in both cases, were in large part created by the U.S. at a different period and have blown back since. Doesn't mean that, well, especially that there hasn't been a history of secular democratic movements in the Middle East. There very much was, and these were really identified to be crushed by the U.S. in the 50s and 60s and before because of the oil there. Put it in a nutshell, it's a priority to smash movements which would be more sympathetic and would have a greater chance of really building an alternative. So this has been a really vexing problem, I think, within the globalization movement, because there's no horse in there to identify with, as there would be, say, in Chiapas, where people can clearly identify, or the, say, the indigenous struggles in Ecuador and Bolivia. Clearly, there's the politics are something which are very congruent with the politics, you know, of Seattle and so on. But I think in order to deal with this, I think people have to really educate themselves about the war in particular. And I think to fill that vacuum that's otherwise being filled by all kinds of other theories about what's going on, I think it's important to sort of be out there with some accurate information about what's going on. And I think that makes a big difference. I think there's a real hunger for that.
Obviously, in the concept of globalization, one of the key things has been that there's been a tie into the military and militarization. That seems to kind of be the, if you have a carrot and a stick, you know, the carrot is free trade, and if you don't perform and pay up on the debts, then you're going to see the military end of things. Do you think that we're kind of seeing something similar to that in the Middle East, in Iraq, where they just skip the first part and move directly to the second part?
Yeah, there's a really definitely an intimate relationship there between militarization, imperialism, you know, violence, basically, and globalization. I mean, capitalist globalization. I mean, you go back to Britain in the era of free trade, there was supposedly this is the time of free trade and comparative advantage. You know, each country produces what it's best at. And this is a myth, of course. It was imposed through British military superiority. You know, the markets of Egypt and India, to name a couple, and China were opened up through violence, and British products were dumped there after the destruction of local production. So this is a long story. But during the period, the post-war period, this violence was primarily outsourced to nominally independent governments. So you had, you know, in Latin America, the military trained at the Army School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, and were basically trained in counterinsurgency. And the militaries were trained to, like, target their own people, essentially. And this was how these regimes were imposed. But to make a long story short, of course, the movements that we saw that arrived here in Seattle made this increasingly difficult, because enough of the leaders and generals of the global South were basically saying, look, we can't go on anymore massacring our own people. The movements have become too powerful, particularly as the movements in the South became more politically sophisticated. You know, they realized that we're a popular movement. You know, we can't fight the state head on. So the sort of armed struggle idea, which was very prevalent in the 60s and which failed virtually everywhere and justified state repression from the point of view of the state, that gave way to mass popular movements, general strikes, boycotts, you know, just mass mobilizations. And it was much harder for the state to deal with. So you just had massive noncompliance and, in large part, nonviolent direct action. This was proved to be much more effective. So really, this resistance, I mean, in the case of, say, Argentina, like, you know, there's been, I think, four or five governments in the last 2 years that have fallen. And the leaders, who, of course, benefit from capitalist globalization, you know, they can always get their money out. And they all went to school at Chicago and Stanford and Harvard, so they know the doctrine. They're all schooled in neoliberal economics. They basically said, we just can't do this anymore. So this was a serious crisis for the system as it stood, for the neoliberal system, because how could it be imposed if the debt couldn't be collected and if there was just refusal to accept the austerity? And I think this does lay the groundwork for what happened after 9/11 in terms of the ascendancy of these neoconservatives, right? And I'm sure a lot of listeners are, probably pay a lot of attention to the factions within Washington politics. And pretty clearly there's a faction sometimes called the Hawks, which have always been there in power but have never had total control. It appears that they have total control now, and they're doing what they've always advocated doing, which is using American military supremacy. U.S. military is by far the most powerful in the world. And Emanuel Wallerstein, who writes in this book, really one of the scholars who's really been very, very insightful in terms of predicting in some ways things that are going on, he argued that, it's the neoconservatives and the Hawks are the only faction of American power that understood that the U.S. was in long-term decline, because Japan and Germany and China are rising to compete with the U.S. economically, and that therefore they understood that the U.S. military supremacy is the last area, the last sphere of power that the U.S. has really a huge advantage. So their project was to use it. And they've used it in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's failed. It's failed to do what they intended to do. It's not been the success. The neoconservatives were saying that the American troops would be greeted with flowers and candy and so on, and this hasn't happened. And it's been a great tragedy, of course, for the Iraqi people and for the American troops. But it's also been a decisive failure for this faction of power and for this policy. So what happens next is very wide open. And that's why I think it's important for people who are interested in the fate of the world to pay attention to what's going on. Because the neoliberal model that was protested against in Seattle in 1999 has come into crisis. But also this sort of what Naomi Klein calls privatization, armed privatization. Right, because you remember when Bremer came into Iraq, the first thing was to pass laws which basically created an investor's paradise, and that hasn't worked at all, but that was the plan. So that hasn't worked either. So what next? It's unclear, but there's tremendous opportunities, I think, for popular movements worldwide to begin to demand more democracy, more quality of life, more environmental safeguards, all these kinds of things which we've been basically told were impossible. The movements are saying it has to be possible, because this world of endless war and the spoliation of the environment and degradation of human rights and living standards is not acceptable.
And one of the characteristics of these solutions coming from beyond our borders is the fact that I think a lot of them look towards medium and long-term solutions, where here in the U.S. we've kind of been raised towards the fast food solution idea, where if we don't see results the next day or within the next week or so, a lot of people start walking away or feeling dejected or whatever, they lose their energy level. Can you address that, how we really need to start making that shift towards longer term vision?
Yeah, I think the key difference, we've been talking about this a lot, the difference between the U.S. and other places in the world, and I think one of the key things is community. That is, in other places in the world and in the U.S., especially amongst people of color, communities of color, Native American communities, and other communities that are relatively tight-knit, there's a sense of a longer-term project and a sense of patience and a sense of support. And very often, in the rich countries, there's people are coming from very alienated suburbs. People are coming out of a culture of consumption. and are sort of trying to create communities with greater or lesser success. I think with actually a lot of success in some cases. But still, there is a difference. If you look at where is the movement strongest, both in terms of sustainable campaigning and also in terms of theory, in terms of coming up with ideas, it's in places which traditional radicals would have thought would be unlikely places, places that are the margins of the economy and the world system, places like, you know, again, Chiapas, you know, the indigenous areas of Ecuador and Bolivia, Ogoni and Ijaw peoples in Nigeria, people from the shanty towns of South Africa, Indian peasants. What's going on that there's such resilience and such imaginative forms of resistance? I think it does have to do with the fact that there's been less penetration by capitalist forms of life. And those very forms of life, traditional forms of life, are, of course, under threat now. So one of the key concepts that is being circulated around the world now is that of enclosure, right? That really capitalism is characterized as much by exploitation, of course. You think of that as one of the key terms, but also by enclosure of commons, of aspects of life that were previously held in common and which were sort of seen to be outside of the market and the commodity form. So, for example, common lands, right? What's the reason for the massive dispossession of people around the world? Why is it that people are being forced to be migrants and are coming to the U.S. and other countries and will work for anything and will risk their lives? I mean, this year, you know, dozens of people have died crossing the Arizona desert to come here to work at very bad jobs. Why are they doing this? Well, they're being displaced. They're being displaced by enclosure. Often they're people that have been in their communities for hundreds of years, if not longer, but they're being displaced now. Enclosure also affects the air, the water in particular, the privatization of water. It affects urban areas, and it affects commons such as, again, the airwaves, struggles over the airwaves. And, of course, it affects now with the new technology, biodiversity, right? The privatization of seeds, privatization of species, privatization of, you know, rainforests. So a lot of battles against the attempt to force farmers to pay for seeds from agribusiness companies. Okay, so all of these forms of enclosure have elicited resistance, and the resistance from people who are less enclosed, if you will, than people in the U.S. Because after all, in the U.S., even though many people have a high standard of living, have a lot of material goods, what they've been completely dispossessed of is any sense of community, any sense of place. And those are the things that in this global South and in some communities in the U.S., there are riches in. You know, so the people of Chiapas may be materially poor, but they have riches of another kind, and that's sort of the bedrock of resistance. And so this is where I think, again, this idea of listening to the South is important. And a book like this one is a place to start, because there are direct accounts from these struggles and, you know, what goes into it. And so I think this is something that you see in the U.S. when extraordinary circumstances happen. This is, again, it's why I think summits are important, but also just thinking about when something extraordinary happens. Earthquakes, for example. I've been in a couple earthquakes in California where people do come together and all of a sudden realize that they have, again, more power than they know, that they don't need the state to do everything for them, that they can work together, and that human nature, when left to its own, is not just to compete with each other or to loot from each other. This is what we're told by capitalism in general. This is one of the ideologies going back to Hobbes, is you need the state because otherwise it's going to be a perpetual war of each against all. What actually happens in the event of, say, an earthquake is people usually come together. That's what I've seen, and that's the case all over the world. So sometimes an extraordinary event is what's needed for people to realize that, in fact, they have more resources than they realize. And so the challenge, of course, is how to sustain this and how to build this up. But I think we just have to identify that challenge. And maybe the circumstances coming up now in the U.S. will make that a necessity. Who knows? But I know there's a Northwest Social Forum that's being planned, which I think is an attempt to bring people together to discuss these questions. And hopefully it'll be outreach, again, away from, you know, the usual suspects. Because I think a lot of people in this country are sort of in the suburb or someplace where they think that they're the only person that sees through the lies of the media, for example. But they're not alone. So how to link together, it's a project that has to happen.
Yeah, that social forum is coming up in October. And from what I've heard, it's not going to be the usual suspects that are pulling things together, which is very inspiring. Only got about 5 minutes left. I was wondering if you could share with us maybe some more positive aspects of things where, you know, a lot of us have been via our daily newspapers, TV, kind of get our hopes crushed by thinking that things are about as bad as they could be, yet, as you point out and as you bring together in your book, Confronting Capitalism, there's a lot of good things that are happening, and there's every reason to keep one's hopes bolstered.
Yes, well, I mean, let's just, you know, start again. I think I mentioned it, you know, earlier, but it's important to remember that neoliberalism, this ideology, which was basically says everything should be for sale, and the only thing left to negotiate is the price, right? This ideology that said that the human genome, the airshed, the watershed, all species, everything is a commodity. Everything can be treated this way. And this ideology that the only thing that people can do is basically consume, is the reduction of citizenship to consumption, and the total immiseration of most of the world, because there was a sacrifice being made that the majority of the world would not be included in this. This ideology has been effectively shattered, thanks to the social movements. And Seattle, 99 in Seattle, was no small part in that. The people of the world were incredibly invigorated by the fact that huge amounts of people in the U.S. came out and resisted the WTO, which really symbolized this ideology. And if you've traveled anywhere in the world, people know what Seattle was. And people were very happy, because often our leaders always try to conflate the government with the populace. And so to the extent that that's successful, people think, oh, all Americans support Bush and are just totally ignorant and this whole stereotype. The events like Seattle in 99, events like the anti-war protests in 2003, show to the world that there's conscious communities and conscious people in the U.S. They show that there's compassion in the U.S. They show that there's people in the U.S. that aren't just concerned with their consumption. And this is an incredibly powerful thing. So, you know, two ideas here. One is that these demonstrations do have an impact in terms of creating a difference, a distinction between governments and populaces. That's one of the most important things that can be done now, because the leaders always make this conflation. And that's what you have in war situations. You have an attack on the enemy. There's no discrimination between who the enemy is. It's very, very dangerous, the dehumanization process. And that can be working against Americans now. And that's one of the reasons why the Bush administration has made Americans much less safe around the world, because Bush is constantly saying, I represent the Americans, I speak for all Americans. So to be able to contest that and say, no, there's people that don't subscribe to this, there's people that don't endorse what's going on, that's very important. But also, you know, neoliberalism has been really discredited. And a proof of this is the fact that a lot of its chief advocates, Joseph Stiglitz, who's a former head of the World Bank, Jeffrey Sachs, who was overseer of the shock treatment in Russia, which just totally destroyed everything that was good and modern about Russian society. That is, it was, in fact, the superpower. It did have some healthcare, education system, a science establishment. All these things were destroyed under his doctrines, which he learned, of course, from the economics departments. He's come out and said, this is insane. This has been a disaster. So these people, these experts, many of them have jumped ship. But the reason they jumped ship is because of the powerful movements, that the globalization or anti-globalization movements. That's the reason. And so it's important to take credit for that, to realize that it did make a difference. It's made a huge historical difference. Neoliberalism, I don't think, can ever come back. It's been so discredited. People now will look at it and say, how could, you know, this have been the doctrine that which dominated the entire world? It's actually an insane doctrine. And so, of course, the reason it's hard to celebrate is, of course, it was replaced immediately by this sort of permanent war project, which we're seeing, which, of course, had it been successful, is certainly worse, right? Because, you know, had it been successful, had the U.S. been able to sort of conquer Iraq, it was going to go ahead. The plan was to go ahead with Syria, Iran, North Korea, Colombia. But this hasn't been the case. And so, again, this doctrine has also failed in some part to the global anti-war movement. You know, the largest demonstrations in human history, which took place February 15th of 2003. And that's important to remember, that this did have a huge role. So the movement has been much more successful, I think, than people give it credit for. And I think it's also been successful in building long-lasting alliances. You know, the World Social Forums in Brazil and in India, well, there's now going to be a social forum here, but the social forum is precisely an attempt to reformulate democracy from the bottom up. And so the fact that this is an ongoing project shows, again, that, you know, so these are sort of the larger macro victories. And I also think the local aspect of it is really crucial right now. And I think people find ways to plug in. I think that there will be more and more ways to plug in as you start seeing more and more crises. I think the point of reading right now, of trying to understand what people in the South have been learning and have to teach us, is that there are ways to link these different things, whether you're concerned about the collapse of the public schooling system in the U.S. or about the expansion of the prison system, all of these things are intimately related. And so finding those connections and then finding ways to network around those connections, that's something I think that's very possible right now.
So on one level, it's almost ironic. We've been extracting all these resources from the Global South for decades, and now the final thing to fix things will be the willing extraction of the ideas and solutions.
Yeah, and I don't want to sort of put it too much on too much of a pedestal, except to say that usually there's not a lot of listening to, you know, I mean, put it this way. I mean, everybody in the world knows hundreds of Americans by name. Most Americans, they know one Iraqi individual. That's what I'm saying. You know, there's an incredible asymmetry in terms of knowledge. The U.S. is a superpower also culturally, which is in some ways something that sort of saves the U.S. From Bush's conflation, because, you know, you go to places in the world, people love aspects of U.S. culture that are dissonant. You know, people love punk rock or hip-hop, things that are clearly anti-establishment. But if you look at it, how many individuals can the U.S. name from any country in Latin America or Asia? Probably very few, even amongst, you know, folks who are pretty well in the know. And it does seem to me that right now this is where a lot of the innovative theorizing as well as practice is taking place, just these particular historical circumstances. But it's also taking place in parts of the U.S. that are maybe also neglected. Again, the examples I mentioned. But I don't want to, you know, sort of say it's ever and always been the case. But right now, clearly, I think, given the level of alienation in the U.S., there's a lot of people that think that they're the only person awake and figuring stuff out. They're not alone. So I think that there's a lot to be learned right now. Just one last thing on this. The social movements in the U.S. have been really innovative in a lot of things around tactics, around direct action, which was really honed during the protests in the 70s and 80s, not the 60s, you know, the nonviolent direct action protests against nuclear power and against the arms industry, Central American intervention. So this is something that the U.S. has to teach a lot of places in the world. The same with consensus process and certain practice of direct democracy, which started in the civil rights movement, the African-American civil rights movement in the South, particularly SNCC, and also was kept alive by the women's movement, especially in the 70s. So these are things that the U.S. has to offer. On the flip side, though, in the U.S., there's often been a kind of anti-intellectualism, a real kind of neglect of theory. You know, sort of this action comes first, and then we'll figure out everything else later. And I think that that's something that the U.S. can learn from other parts of the world, that in the South, even though people are fighting very intense struggles, they'll take the time to really discuss neoliberalism, capitalism, globalization, you know, all these terms which we sort of write off or often are sometimes lazy with. And so I think that's a theme that maybe people can learn from, because now we're in a period where there's not going to be the big, easy demonstration that everybody can go to necessarily. It's going to be, again, a more complex struggle, and I think it does help to try to understand the world that we live in, basically.
We've just been talking with Eddie Yuen. He is one of the co-editors for the new book, Confronting Capitalism, Dispatches from a Global Movement.
And the interviewer was Mike McCormick. And on the same topic, Bay Area global justice activist David Solnit will be in Ithaca on August 11th to speak about his new book, and on how the shared principles of new radicalism connect grassroots struggles across the planet into an unprecedented and hopeful global movement. Solnit was a key organizer of the WTO protests in Seattle in 1999, as well as with direct action to stop the war's shutdown of San Francisco's financial district the day after Iraq was invaded in 2003. That's Wednesday, August 11th, 7:30 p.m. at Bush Must Go headquarters, which is above Autumn Leaves Used Bookstore on the Ithaca Commons. For more information, contact Sigrid at area code 607-272-0407, 272-0407. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Which will come down.